Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, June is Alzheimer's Awareness Month. Jay Fox will speak with an expert about a new study regarding early detection. Jay will also have a conversation about summer storm safety, and he'll discuss cardiovascular disease with a doctor who specializes in heart health. Plus, Doug Petcash of Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective.
The month of June marks Alzheimer's and Brain Awareness Month. And the Alzheimer's Association is urging people to recognize the early signs and symptoms of the disease and other dementias in their loved ones. In Ohio, an estimated 236,000 people are living with the disease, and Franklin County has a higher incidence than most other counties in the state. Dr. Carl Hill from the Alzheimer's Association joins us now on Columbus Perspective to discuss the disease that could impact as many as 14 million in our country by 2060. Good morning, Dr. Hill.
Hi, good morning, Jay. Great to be here with you.
We appreciate your time. Let's jump right in. What does the latest data on Alzheimer's disease reveal, and how does it impact the daily life of the patient in 2025?
I tell you, you said it really well. You know, more than 7 million Americans are living with Alzheimer's, which is the sixth leading cause of death among people aged 65 years and older. We estimate that the lifetime risk for Alzheimer's dementia at 45 is approximately 1 in 5 for women and 1 in 10 for men. And so it is just critical, you know, that we get the word out about this Alzheimer's and other dementia crisis, and that people know what the early signs and symptoms are. Because for the first time, you know, we have treatments that slow that cognitive decline, you know, once people are diagnosed. But it's only available to individuals in the early stages of disease. And this makes early detection and diagnosis critically important.
So let's talk about those early warning signs of Alzheimer's disease. And then we can talk about, you know, some other signs that might not be Alzheimer's. How do you know if you are at risk or you have a problem?
I tell you, some early signs are, you know, memory loss that disrupts daily life, or challenges in planning or solving problems, difficulty completing tasks, you know. But it's important, to your point, Jay, to think about typical age-related changes, you know, things like, you know, making a bad decision once in a while. You know, I did that in my 20s, or missing a monthly payment. You know, I probably have done that in the past. You know, versus an inability to manage a budget, you know, or, you know, noticing a loved one with poor judgment and decision making, or, you know, losing track of the date or season. And so, you know, it's important. It's really important. And this campaign is, you know, really driving people to understand, you know, the early signs. And so I urge your listeners to go over to 10signs.org. You know, some really good information about distinguishing what you mentioned as typical age-related changes and signs of Alzheimer's and dementia. Really important.
So if I find myself in the kitchen wondering why I'm there, that's not necessarily a problem.
It could be, you know, it could be. And if it's if it happens routinely, you know, Jay, then, you know, it may be time to have, you know, a discussion. You know, things like, you know, having trouble following a familiar recipe, or keeping track of monthly bills, or, you know, so anytime you see a loved one struggling with familiar tasks or frequently forgetting important dates or names, you know, it may be a sign that it's time to have a conversation. And, you know, there may not be Alzheimer's or other dementia, but again, early detection, you know, missing these opportunities to get a diagnosis really limits the opportunity for effective treatments that are available.
So whether I'm dealing with my own personal health or I'm dealing with my parents' health, do we start by going to a primary care physician, or do we immediately start with a neurologist?
I would suggest that you start with a primary care physician to get an adequate diagnosis, because here's a key, I think, important part of this is that, There could be other, there could be symptoms that are related to other outcomes, right? And so to get a diagnosis, it's important for a primary care physician to rule out other things, you know, so a combination of, you know, assessing medical history or neurological exams, cognitive assessment. This is what, you know, primary care physicians can do. And then, you know, if there's still a risk for Alzheimer's and other dementia, this can be confirmed by brain imaging or cerebrospinal fluid analysis. But the first, I think, an important, you know, component here is, you know, knowing some of the signs and symptoms, knowing, you know, how important early detection is, you know, so that you can get, you know, a diagnosis and the treatments that are available.
When it comes to heart disease and stroke, the African-American community has a disproportionate rate of mortality and of incidents. We're finding out now that increased rates of Alzheimer's for Black Americans is also part of the problem. Why do you think that is?
I tell you, this, and this is important from a health disparities research perspective. Black African Americans 2 times more likely to be diagnosed and living with Alzheimer's or another dementia. And as you mentioned, was good for the heart. It's good for the brain, you know, and over the life course, unfortunately, Black African-Americans disproportionately affected by diabetes, you know, hypertension, you know, most likely to have unfortunately suffered a stroke, you know, and this influences the blood, the quality of the blood that flows to the brain and puts people at risk for Alzheimer's or another dementia over their life course. And so it's important that we get, Black African-Americans information about a healthy lifestyle, you know, physical activity, you know, nutrition, you know, staying cognitively engaged in ways that are effective. You know, that's health equity, is thinking about, you know, ways to get people information that they trust in effective ways. And so this campaign certainly looks to do that. And then, as you mentioned, Black African Americans less likely to receive any type of diagnosis, you know, and to not know any of the warning signs or symptoms to go and see their primary care physician or to seek out a neurologist. And so, again, this campaign, you know, looks to get information to communities, all communities, particularly Black African Americans who are disproportionately affected, so that they can act when it's time and when they notice, you know, some of these signs and symptoms, to get a proper diagnosis.
Doctor, how much of this is genetic and how much of this is diet?
Well, the disparities research says that, you know, the genetic component does not explain the disproportionate risk for Black African Americans. I mean, there's a genetic risk component here where people have the APOE4 gene, but there are other factors, like I mentioned, lifestyle factors. You know, people, you know, maintaining good cardiovascular health over their life course. You know, what does that mean? Managing stress, you know, knowing how to turn to healthy options for nutrition, or, you know, staying, you know, physically active as long as possible. You know, again, I mentioned what's good for the heart is good for the brain. You know, receiving proper support, you know, to do those things, you know, really staying away from alcohol abuse and cigarette use, all the things that are really good for cardiovascular health. Because the Lancet Commission, group of really smart researchers, you know, found a few years ago that upwards to 40% of global dementia was preventable. And they identified modifiable risk factors that include some of these health behaviors that I just mentioned. And so giving people information that they can use and ways that they can use it, you know, providing support for people to maintain a healthy lifestyle and giving them resources to do that certainly can go a long way for people reducing their risk for developing Alzheimer's or dementia along their life course.
So there's a new public service campaign that's called Some Things Come With Age. What is the premise and what is the goal of this campaign, and where are we going to see it?
Hey, you will see this on television soon, and people can go to 10signs.org to get the important information at their own leisure to be updated. But the goal of this is to really get people to understand and talk about what typical age-related changes are and what signs of Alzheimer's and dementia can be. You know, it is, I tell you, as I mentioned earlier, there are many age-related changes that, you know, I deal with right now. And being able to distinguish between those and what signs of Alzheimer's and dementia can be, I think is really, really important in this fight to end Alzheimer's. That's one, you know, really important goal. And then the second one is, as I mentioned, you know, getting information to disproportionately affected populations like Black African Americans in ways that are effective and that are equitable. You know, understanding the disproportionate effect here, the diversity in pathway, you know, people and their risks. You know, you mentioned, you know, there's a genetic risk, but for many populations, their risk is, you know, related to modifiable risk factors, you know, things that they may be able to pay closer attention to reduce their risk over the life course. And so getting people that information, you know, addressing health disparities is getting people resources. That has always been one component of, you know, sound public health and addressing health disparities. And so these are important resources. You know, 10signs.org, this campaign, the Alzheimer's Association with our many resources, 1-800-272-3900. These are resources that people could use to be better informed, to make better decisions, to get a diagnosis, and to potentially reduce their risk for developing Alzheimer's or another dementia.
Last question for you this morning, Doctor. Did the study show that increased socialization has a positive impact on reduction as opposed to isolation, which might have a negative impact and be part of causation?
I tell you, it's really important. And so one of the modifiable risk factors that that Lancet Commission found was that social isolation, you know, played a really important role in people's risk over time. You know, so staying cognitively engaged, you know, having a hobby, you're talking to loved ones, you know, finding ways to stay connected is really, really important work and important for reducing risk for Alzheimer's and dementia. And so, yes, absolutely. It can be really critical in staying cognitively engaged, is what we call it, to be sure that you're reducing your risk for Alzheimer's or another dementia.
So this website, 10 Signs, is it 10 Signs or is it T-E-N Signs?
10signs.org. 10signs.org. We're urging everyone to take a look, to become better informed, so you'll know what you're dealing with as it pertains to signs and symptoms, you know, and the normal signs of aging. I think it's an important conversation for families to have, for churches to have, for fraternities and sororities, all great information, I think, to get the conversation started about knowing the early warning signs.
Absolutely. And we can all sing the old Whisper song, Just Gets Better With Time, rather than forgetting all of the wonderful things that happened in our lives.
That's a classic track. That's a classic one, Jay, for sure.
There you go. We want to thank Dr. Carl Hill for being with us from the Alzheimer's Association. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
Last year, the state of Ohio set a record for tornadoes with 74. The last one occurred on December 29th. While this year's number is far below last year's at this time, storm season is upon us, and being prepared means staying alive. Joining us today on Columbus Perspective from a Mobile, Alabama claims center on the ground are Allstate claims leaders Andrea Bessling and Roland Jean-Louis to share some practical tips to help us keep safe. before that next big storm hits, which could, in fact, be at any moment. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Jay. We appreciate the opportunity.
Yes, thank you so much. We're excited to talk to you today.
Your team recently conducted a survey to test the preparedness of families for these types of emergencies. What did the survey reveal?
Actually, the survey helped us to better understand that two-thirds, nearly 66% of the homeowners and the renters that were surveyed did not have an emergency evacuation plan. There was no emergency kit that they had readily available to take with them and leave to go to a safe place. And many may not even fully understand the risk of catastrophic weather and how that could impact them and their family. This has proven true based on the work that we've done responding to catastrophe. The weather isn't waiting. It's getting real bad, and it's not slowing.
So when a tornado comes through and it destroys a residence or a building or, in some cases, an entire town, if you don't have your documentation on your person, what kind of trouble are you going to have in terms of filing a claim or getting any kind of assistance or help?
Well, we will help you with every aspect of filing a claim. So to prepare, if you have time to prepare, you know, you want to have an evacuation plan and you want to have an emergency kit. And emergency kit would include things like your documentation, things that you take on a daily basis from prescription medication. So in the future, you do have time to plan, so it's not too late for that. If you didn't have that information, Allstate would gladly guide you through the process, take your information, and help facilitate your need to file a claim and process the claim. So we would help you with that.
Does preparedness for severe thunderstorms and tornadoes include creating a safe shelter in your home and perhaps stocking it with food that is easily accessible and doesn't require electricity to heat?
Absolutely. There should always be a designated safe place in the home in the event sudden weather comes to the area. That should be planned with the family in advance so that if there's no notice, everyone knows where to go and there's ready supplies in the event you would need to remain in that area for an extended period of time.
When you guys say you're in good hands, what do you do to prepare for storms like this? And in other parts of the country, you know, obviously hurricanes are an issue too.
Absolutely. Whether it's hurricanes or tornadoes, Allstate is always ready. We're prepared. And today, we are in Mobile, Alabama, as you mentioned, with some of our mobile claim centers, which we have 20 of these in our fleet. You know, these vehicles have satellite technology, GPS systems, weather mapping technology, and they're stored strategically across the country so that with our people, we can readily respond to any disaster, whether it's a hurricane, whether it's a tornado, and quickly respond to help customers safely and also help them maintain and restore their lives.
Do you guys employ meteorologists so that you know when these storms are going to occur?
We partner with a lot of persons who specialize in weather to offer us the information that we need to make decisions to ensure that our equipment is safe, to make sure that our people that are part of the response is safe, and to offer any information that's beneficial to our customers to make sure they remain safe.
What do you do in a case of the St. Louis situation where the tornado warning sirens failed to discharge and that tornado hit the city proper and a lot of low-income people, you know, found themselves in harm's way without any notice? How does Allstate deal with that?
We offer them the opportunity to, review some of the information that we provide to the general public relative to safety, you know, relative to recovery, and that's the best way that we can help not only our Allstate customers but the public in general.
So if I am planning my summer vacation and possibly my fall travel, what should I be thinking about in terms of severe weather impact if I'm going to travel in the country?
We mentioned earlier about having emergency kits. That's mm-hmm. critical, because if you're not home and something happens at home, if you've got that emergency kit, that should have valuable information that would help you begin the recovery process.
I agree. And you have to think about, regardless of the disaster, your preparation is going to be fairly dissimilar, right? So you're going to have your evacuation plan depending on the disaster. You're going to have your safe place to go depending on the risk. You know, you're going to have that emergency kit, you know, that first aid kit that you can travel with and keep in your car. You're going to take a home inventory before you leave. Everyone has smartphones. Go through and video your personal property. Upload that to the cloud so you have it. Make sure you review your insurance. Contact your agent and understand the risk that you face along with the coverage that you have, so that you have the coverage when you need it.
Wouldn't it make sense to have more than one emergency kit? Obviously, you have one in your car. Maybe you have one in your purse, and you know, maybe you have one in your shelter in your basement. And shouldn't that also include like your passwords and all that too?
Absolutely. Allstate offers customers to store valuable information on the cloud, which includes the inventory that we mentioned, right? So many people access this information wirelessly, and that way it's always safe, it's always secure, and it's easy accessible.
Yes, and I would say don't be overwhelmed about the thought of creating a plan. Start with one or two things, and then as you take advantage of being able to successfully do that, then you can go to having a kit in your car, having a kit in your home. That's why it's important to be prepared so that you can be safe and also be protected and ready in the event of disaster.
And I would also think common sense plays a role too. You know, don't travel to some place that you know is going to have a hurricane in the next few, you know, weeks, or if you know you're going to have a storm, then maybe it's a good idea to stay home, right?
That's definitely an option.
All right. If folks want to learn more about preparedness and how you guys address it, is there a website they can go to?
Absolutely. We'd highly recommend that they visit allstate.com and review our Good Hands Recovery Guide. That would be a very good resource for the public.
All right. We want to thank Andrea and Roland for being with us today. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
Heart disease is the leading cause of death for working-age Ohioans. Those numbers are highest in Columbus by population. For the thousands in our area who have experienced a heart attack or might be concerned about having a heart attack, new research about the ECTRIM trial presented at the American College of Cardiology's 74th Annual Scientific Session and Expo gives us an important update in prevention. Dr. Matthew Budoff is a nationally recognized cardiologist and lead investigator of the trial, and he joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Doctor, thanks for sharing your time today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
What role does inflammation play in heart disease, and why is it often overlooked?
Yeah, so inflammation kind of stirs the plaque, causes the plaque to build up and causes more heart attacks, strokes, and even cardiac death. Unfortunately, it's often overlooked because it requires a separate blood test to know if people have inflammation or not. It's not something that the doctors can do by physical exam or by our typical labs that we commonly order.
What are the symptoms that could lead one to believe they need such a test?
Yeah, so it could be kind of a silent disease. We recommend that patients, if they're at risk of heart disease, let's say they have a family history of heart disease, or they know they have some blockages building up in their arteries, ask their doctor about inflammation and if that can be playing a role.
And inflammation is something where, correct me if I'm wrong, it's an actual inflammation of the organs or the arteries or veins. What do we mean by inflammation?
Yeah, so we think that there's the cells in the body are literally attacking the blood vessels in the heart, the coronary arteries. So we think that there's the inflammation is kind of your body over-responding to a stimulus. That's why people get inflammation if they have like arthritis or if they have other diseases, they can get inflammation. But this we think is inflammation of the arteries themselves around the heart.
So what did the Ekstrom trial reveal about, and I'm going to try to pronounce this correctly, low-dose colchicine's impact on artery health? Did I get that right?
Perfect. Perfect. Yes. Yeah. So colchicine is a drug that we've been using for gout, for a different disease for decades. And we found out that it helps with in a low dose, just 0.5 milligrams, one pill a day, can help with the inflammation of the heart itself. So it can literally reduce the inflammation around the coronary arteries. And we showed in our trial that it slows the plaque buildup in the arteries. We did what's called a non-invasive angiogram using a CT scanner and showed that if you're taking colchicine on top of your other regular medicines, it slows down the buildup of plaque in the arteries over the course of a year.
Now, is there any conflict with blood thinners or statins or high blood pressure medications?
Yeah, fortunately, no. It really is complementary to those other therapies. So if you're already on low-dose aspirin, if you're already on a statin or blood pressure medicine or even diabetes medicine, it's fine to add in colchicine if your doctor thinks it's the right medicine for you.
So when we look at this anti-inflammatory approach, how does this change the paradigm from what we've been doing for the past 50 years?
Yeah, so, we've attacked heart disease, the number one cause of death in both men and women in the U.S. for decades, with blood pressure medicine and cholesterol medicine and aspirin. But we haven't gone after the inflammation, and we think that's the missing quarter of the treatment that we haven't been going after. And we think that there's a lot of patients who are susceptible to having inflammation that would benefit from being on a drug like colchicine.
Will this drug also be able to impact other organs that are negatively impacted by inflammation, like the liver, for example?
It's possible. Our research, I'm a cardiologist, so our research was mostly focused on the coronary arteries. But certainly if there's inflammation in other parts of the body, especially arthritis, it may have a role because gout is a disease of the joints and colchicine, the same drug, is used in higher doses for that as well. So it definitely has more roles to play than just the coronary arteries.
I'm in my late 50s and I come to you and I say, doctor, I want to have the healthiest possible heart I can have for the next 30 years of my life. What are you going to tell me?
I'm going to say that we need to get at least a calcium score, at least a study of your arteries to see if you have any plaque. And if you have plaque, then we want to know if you have inflammation. And I would send you for a blood test to look for that inflammation in your body. And if you have inflammation and you have plaque building up in your arteries, I would talk to you about colchicine.
If we want to learn more about this, or perhaps for those brave enough, we want to read the entire trial study, is there a website we can go to?
Yes, yeah. So cvdinflammation.com. So all one word, cvdinflammation.com.
All right. We want to thank Dr. Matthew Budoff for being with us. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV, here's Doug Petcash from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV.
Ohio lawmakers are racing to the finish line on the state's two-year, $61 billion operating budget. As the General Assembly wraps up its business on this major legislation, the House Minority Leader is wrapping up her business in that leadership role. State Representative Allison Russo of Upper Arlington has served as House Minority Leader since January of 2022. Early this month, Russo announced she is stepping down as Minority Leader at the end of June to pave the way for a smooth transition of leadership before the legislature's summer break. She said she wanted to stay in leadership through the operating budget negotiations. She also said any decisions about her political future will come at a later time. Joining me now to talk about the transition, what's next, and the state budget is Ohio House Minority Leader, State Representative Allison Russo. State Representative, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Doug, for having me.
Absolutely. So why is now the right time for you to step away from leadership?
Yeah, well, I think any good leader knows that timing is key, and we are finishing up probably one of the most important things, if not the most important thing that we do in the legislature, and that is to pass the state operating budget. We'll be going into a long summer break before coming back later in September. And so it's a good time. It's a good time to transition, to get the new team settled, and to help with that transition. And we will have the budget behind us. And so, you know, I said in the beginning to my caucus members I would get them through the budget. So here we are. And you know, it's time to move on and pass the torch to someone else.
And you've chosen not to endorse a successor. Why not?
Well, it's important to me that the caucus make this decision about what the leadership of the caucus looks like next. That said, there appears to only be one candidate or person who's put their name in the ring for the next minority leader. You know, a couple of other positions that are up for competition. But again, you know, I respect the process of my caucus and want to be supportive of whatever that leadership team looks
like. Who is that person, can you say?
So it appears that the next leader is likely to be Representative Denny Isaacson from the Cincinnati area, and he's been part of my leadership team for the last 2 years. So, you know, I'm excited to see him possibly move into this
role. Do you feel it'll be a smooth transition with him if it does end up that way?
Oh, most certainly. I think it will be a smooth transition no matter who is at the helm. I have worked pretty hard over the last several years and during my time as the minority leader to make sure that we've got good infrastructure, both on the political and the official side. We've got incredible staff that we've brought in over the last couple of years. And so I feel confident that whoever takes over in those leadership roles will be able to continue that work and continue to grow the caucus and our priorities.
What would you say that you're most proud of, I guess, in your 3.5 years as leader as far as accomplishments go?
Well, I think there are many things that I am proud of. You know, certainly the work that we did last General Assembly to continue to protect and fully fund our public schools with the Fair School Funding Plan. You know, certainly that is at risk in this budget, but we fought really hard to build collaboration across the aisle to protect that. I think I'm also, you know, this is less on the legislative side, but the team that we have been able to build, we both picked up seats, and so a talented pool of members, even though we are small, but also the staff that we've been able to bring in over the years and add, you know, a level of professionalism and expertise that helps our members also be successful.
So what's next for you?
Well, I, you know, as I've said, I am taking July off. I want to spend some time with my family.
Your son just graduated.
I have a son who graduated. He's going off to school, so we're going to get him settled. And, you know, have real serious conversations, not only with my family, but a trusted circle of people around me to, I think, make a decision about what is next. I do not think that my time in public service is done. And so I'm looking forward to what that next adventure will be. But I will finish up my time in the General Assembly. I certainly will not be quiet and still be a voice on many issues.
And you're term limited, right? This is your last term in the House.
That's right. It is my last term in the House, but I will be able to complete that term through the end of 2026.
Now, of course, your name has been brought up as a potential candidate for a bunch of different offices. We've heard it for governor, possibly for U.S. senator and other positions. Are you looking at those possibilities?
Well, I have not taken anything off the table. You know, it's always nice when your name is thrown out. But, you know, for me, it really is about what makes the most sense for me and my family. And for, you know, me moving forward. So have not taken anything off the table, but have not made a decision either.
Do you have a timeline?
I do. You know, I would like to be able to make this decision certainly before the end of the summer.
Okay. I mean, primary will be here before we know it if you decide to go in that direction.
Right.
So what do you think the Democratic Party needs to do now to win back some of these seats? We saw Sherrod Brown lose, and you know the main offices here in the state are Republican held.
Well, I think certainly the last election was a reckoning for us. I think, you know, we, in spite of it being a not very favorable election cycle for Democrats, both nationally and statewide. We had some real successes in the legislative races and actually picked up a couple of seats in spite of that. And what we found to be successful, and I think there's a lot that our state party can learn from that, and Democrats in general, and that is keeping our message and the message overall focused on cost of living for people. People want to be able to go to sleep at night knowing that they have financial security. And what is it that we can do to speak to those issues that really matter to people in terms of building their financial security for the future and making sure that we are investing in children who will be our future and the future strength of this state?
Well, speaking of that, of course, you mentioned the budget negotiations are going on. It's the two-year state operating budget, about $61 billion. How are the negotiations going right now? And I guess, what are your biggest concerns heading into a possible vote next week?
Well, I have huge concerns about this budget. The budget was recently passed by the Senate last week. It is now what we call conference committee. It will come out of conference committee, be voted by us this week, and then go to the governor's desk. But it is full of broken promises. I mean, we see a major underfunding of our public schools. We see a flat tax or a tax break for the wealthiest Ohioans that is at the expense of middle-class families and working families, is at the expense of health care for many Ohioans. We've got hospitals that are at risk of closure right now, not just because of what is happening in Congress with that big, beautiful scam, what I call it, but also what is happening in the state budget. We have lack of investment in child care, which we know is a huge need for working families and cost us well over $5 billion per year and loss in economic revenue in this state, loss of services for our senior citizens. So there is a lot not to like about this budget. It needs significant changes because it benefits the wealthy at the expense of everyday Ohioans, and there will be real long-term damages.
Well, I believe this is going to be the last time I get to talk to you on this show as leader. So I just did want to say thank you also for being accessible and being willing to appear on the show to answer the questions.
Thank you, Doug.
I appreciate it. And best wishes on the future.
Thanks.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Face the State, courtesy of 10TV.
Ohio lawmakers on both sides of the aisle say one of the biggest concerns they hear from their constituents is about high property taxes. They agree something needs to be done, but opinions are split on a massive new tax cut proposal. The bill promises to give Ohioans $3.5 billion in property tax relief. Supporters say it gives taxpayers a break and more of a voice. Opponents say it will hurt public schools and public services. The House Ways and Means Committee heard 2 hours of testimony on House Bill 335. It promises $3.5 billion in property tax relief for homeowners across the state. Republican State Representative David Thomas is sponsoring the bill.
Why do you think HB 335 is the way to go?
Our taxpayers need direct decreases in their tax bills this January. They've had 5 years of tremendous, huge property tax increases they had no say over, and they're demanding either make big decreases, changes for the future, or we're going to change it for you.
In fact, right now, a grassroots group is collecting signatures to try to get a constitutional amendment on the ballot to abolish property taxes in Ohio. Representative Thomas's bill doesn't go that far. It would eliminate inside millages. Those are taxes school districts and local governments can levy without voter approval. Chief Robert Butler, the president of the Ohio Association of Chiefs of Police, says municipalities would lose $650 million per year under the bill.
Without this reliable funding, police departments across Ohio would face hiring freezes, reduction in service, and longer response times, directly undermining our ability to keep our community safe.
Critics say school districts also stand to lose a large portion of revenue. What do you say to those who say this will decimate things like schools, police, and other public services?
So I don't see the issue with giving voters the say over how this will actually work. Why can't we allow voters to have the ability to use income or sales or even actually have their voice say over property taxes?
While more than 50 individuals and organizations gave in-person or written testimony opposing the bill, one supported it in committee. Hannah Cubbins Stevens with Americans for Prosperity Ohio testified the legislation offers many positive long-term reforms.
For too long, Ohio's property taxpayers have borne the brunt of a system that allows for unvoted tax increases, unpredictable spikes in tax bills, and a growing burden on homeowners, particularly seniors and those on fixed incomes.
Wednesday's hearing was just the first official hearing for the bill, but when I asked Representative Thomas if the provisions in the legislation could end up in the state operating budget bill that's due by June 30th, he said anything's possible. Now, the challenge with rising property taxes is very real for some people. Older homeowners say they're being priced out of their homes because their property taxes are just too expensive. Sherry Smith has called her home home since 2000. And she dreams of staying there forever. But skyrocketing property taxes are threatening to push her out. Back in 2000, she paid about $300 every 6 months for property taxes. Now that number has almost doubled, and she's struggling to keep up.
I can't get the food I want. I can't, you know how people go see a relative or something out of town? I can't do that anymore.
If you are elderly or permanently disabled, you can apply for the homestead exemption. It will shield the first $28,000 from taxes. Also, if you think the market value of your property is not correct, you can go to the Franklin County Board of Revision and challenge it. You'll have to bring evidence that your property value is lower than estimated.
Again, that's courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV. From the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM ESPN Columbus.